The Guardian.
Power has been restored to Stormont, but how long will this honeymoon period last? I'm Heather Stewart, and this is Politics Weekly.
What's so great about today is, as I say, that Northern Ireland politicians have put aside their differences, stepped up to the plate, and shown leadership. And
the Northern Ireland Assembly reopened for business on a historic Saturday sitting, where the DUP First Minister and Sinn Féin Deputy First Minister promised to seek common ground. It only took them 3 years to get there. The Prime Minister hailed the momentous day as something to celebrate, but dodged the all-important question on how Westminster plans to fund Stormont, saying devolution was about leadership, not money. Tell that to those reliant on public services in Northern Ireland. So what can we expect from this newly formed executive? Will the issue of Brexit and that border down the Irish Sea bring opposition parties together, or provide an even further wedge between them? Back in London, Boris Johnson tasked the Americans with finding a better alternative to using Huawei's 5G network. This came after a delegation of senior Trump officials flew into the UK to present what they said was evidence about the security risks allegedly posed by the Chinese telecoms company. Their concerns were later shrugged off by the head of MI5, but whether to side with Donald Trump on this controversial issue is just one of the questions facing Boris Johnson as he tries to chart a new role for Britain in the world after Brexit. Last but not least, six become five. Later on, we'll talk about the latest in the Labour leadership campaign. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, after 3 years of dust collecting in Stormont, the revived power-sharing executive got back to work and the MLAs took their seats after 3 years of leaving them empty. So how did we get to this point? The Guardian's Ireland correspondent Rory Carroll brings us up to speed in this report.
Today I have told Arlene Foster that I have tendered my resignation, effective from 5 o'clock today.
I am, of course, disappointed that Martin McGuinness has chosen to take the position he has today. His actions have meant that at precisely the time when we need our government to be active, we will have no government and no obvious way to resolve the RHI problems.
The Northern Ireland Assembly fell apart in January 2017. It was a result of a dispute between the Democratic Unionist Party and Sinn Féin, the two biggest parties in Northern Ireland, DUP representing unionism, of course, and Sinn Féin representing nationalism and republicanism. There was a complete breakdown of trust between the two parties. It had always been a rather awkward marriage, having both of them in power. And Sinn Féin, over time, felt that they were being disrespected and that the DUP was lording it over them. And the final rupture came about over a green energy scheme that was bungled, and hundreds of millions of pounds were wasted. So this was seen as a sign of sleaze and dysfunction, especially within the DUP. And so Sinn Féin walked. They walked away. And for 3 years, Northern Ireland was left without a government. It's lasted for 3 years, this strange vacuum, because the two main parties, the DUP and Sinn Féin, simply did not see a strong enough incentive to get back into power sharing and to resume devolution. The DUP felt that they simply couldn't do really business with Sinn Féin, and Sinn Féin just mistrusted the DUP, and relations between them worsened. And so for a time, voters were actually quite happy with their parties for having thumbed their noses at the other side. But the problem with that was that as months passed into years, we could see the effect on public services were being neglected, big decisions were not being taken, and there was increasing political polarization. And so it became a very toxic environment.
The Irish Language Act includes a provision for the official recognition of Irish and the creation of an Irish language commissioner. The repeal of the ban of Irish in the courts was also to be legislated for. Let me make it clear. At no stage was it envisaged to make Irish compulsory for anybody.
The single biggest sticking point was an Irish Language Act. Sinn Féin said as a condition of it returning to Stormont and dealing again with the DUP that they wanted a standalone Irish Act. And they felt that this was vital to embody respect for Irish culture and Irish political aspirations. the DUP felt that this was unreasonable and that the Irish language had been weaponized in a political sense to ram through a nationalist agenda. And so it became a proxy, really, for a battle of wills between the two sides. And it was what sank an earlier effort to negotiate a compromise in 2018, when actually the DUP and Sinn Féin did agree a provisional path back into government, but then the DUP was unable to sell this to its grassroots, especially the Orange Lodge. And so they then abandoned the deal. So we went back to another year and a half of a political vacuum.
This is not the end of the matter. As far as this party is concerned, we will take every possible legal option open to us to try and stop. If it comes into force tonight, there are other options in terms of repealing, and we will make sure that we do everything we can in our conscience to protect the life of the unborn.
Stormont, which is this rather grand estate just outside Belfast, was largely empty. The executive not meeting, not functioning, and so civil servants were left to do the day-to-day running of the Northern Ireland state. But then meantime, in Westminster, some big important decisions affecting Northern Ireland were, of course, being taken. And notably, in 2019, we had same-sex marriage and abortion rights both being extended across the water to Northern Ireland. And this was done over the vocal protests of the DUP and other groups. But this was Westminster basically imposing direct rule for a few standalone pieces of legislation, very important ones too.
And I think it's a very good day for Northern Ireland and for the people of Northern Ireland. I've had good discussions already.
There were several factors that came together to make this breakthrough possible. One was the most important one was the election of last month. And this completely changed the political calculus in Northern Ireland. Firstly, because the DUP and Sinn Féin were both punished by voters across Northern Ireland. And this was largely because voters were fed up with Stormont being defunct. Voters had seen the damage that this was inflicting on Northern Ireland, and they pinned the blame largely on the DUP and Sinn Féin. And so both parties were really chastened by this. And also for the DUP, there's an additional factor, which was that they lost their leverage in Westminster. Boris Johnson's landslide majority meant that the DUP no longer was able to be the tail that wagged the dog in Westminster. So suddenly for them, all roads were leading back to Stormont. An additional factor was the tactical nous displayed by Julian Smith, the Northern Ireland Secretary of State, who said if Stormont is not restored by January the 13th, there will be fresh assembly elections. Now, in those elections, both parties would fear a fresh hammering at the polls. So they thought, okay, it's either we get back into bed together, albeit in a loveless marriage, or we face yet again the wrath of the voters. Those combination of factors is what brought the DUP and Sinn Féin back into Stormont.
Northern Ireland is succeeding in many ways. It's time for Stormont to move forward and show that together we are stronger for the benefit of everyone.
I see no contradiction whatsoever in declaring our firm commitment to power sharing with unionism in the Stormont Assembly, whilst also initiating a mature and inclusive debate about new political arrangements which examine Ireland's future beyond Brexit.
So after 3 years of this big, large estate being mothballed, the deal was clinched late last week. And so then there was a historic sitting on a Saturday whereby Assembly members returned to the chamber to start, quite metaphorically, kind of dusting off the place. And they had a sitting. And there was a real buzz about the place on Stormont. Finally, politicians were doing what politicians are elected to do, and they'd missed it. Now, that said, the mood was not as, say, euphoric as in 1998 when the Good Friday Agreement was signed, nor as jubilant as 2007 when the DUP and Sinn Féin forged an earlier pact. Then we had Martin McGuinness and Ian Paisley representing their parties, and there was a sense then of the possibility of reconciliation. This time around, it's more a sense of they've been forced into this. They consider this the least worst option. And it's been compared to a shotgun marriage. So aside from the initial buzz, I think there's also a sense that, you know, some major difficulties lie ahead.
And with me to discuss those potential difficulties in the studio are Jill Rutter of UK and a Changing Europe, Jonathan Isaby of Brexit Central, and on the line we have The Guardian's Henry MacDonald. Henry, talk to us a bit about how they've handled those outstanding issues that were sort of overshadowing the talks or the non-talks for such a long time. So there's the language issue, isn't there? And there's also the legacy of the Troubles.
If you drill into the detail, not much. Sinn Féin wanted a standalone on its own Irish Language Act, putting the Irish language fully on par with English. That hasn't happened. The Qualified Act, it will also include Unionist British aspects of Unionist British culture as well, and there are going to be commissioners who will oversee the implementation of language policy, but they will be answerable to the First and Deputy First Minister, so you may end up having ministerial vetoes over certain policies that Irish language activists, for example, might want to implement. You would have a universal dual street signs across the roads and streets of Northern Ireland. That may not happen. The minister might deem, for instance, that putting Irish road signs on the Loyalist Shankill Road mightn't be a good idea, even if they were to stay up for about 5 minutes anyway. But the legacy issue is even more fuzzy. I mean, it really is unresolved, that issue as well. And I think it's going to be poisonous in terms of who was to blame for what during the Northern Ireland Troubles. And I've always said that's one you should be careful for what you wish for, because all kinds of skeletons can come rattling out of the cupboard. So it's just the usual in Northern Ireland. Everybody plays for the score draw.
And does that mean you think that it's potentially quite fragile going forward, that some of those things could kind of rear their heads again?
Oh, yes, I think they are fragile. The big test coming up is the RHI report, the Renewable Energy Scheme report. It's a major report which will be published this coming year and will have severe criticism of a number of key figures, including the First Minister, Arlene Foster. That will be destabilising. I think the issues of legacy, you know, should soldiers and policemen be prosecuted, and will senior members of the IRA be prosecuted, who now might hold political positions in Sinn Féin or something like that, that could potentially be destabilising also. And on top of everything is the things that really people really care about, and that's the health service in particular in Northern Ireland. The longest waiting lists in the UK are in Northern Ireland. It only runs, though, I have to say, for 2 years, because there will be elections to a fresh assembly in 2022. So they might just get a few things done before they have to go to the people again in 2 years' time.
Jill, do you find it surprising that the RHI scandal, the Cash for Ash scandal, is still unresolved, is sort of hanging over them, and yet they've managed to put the pieces back together, for the time being at least?
I think there were sort of debates, I think, about whether actually it made sense to bring the executive back, because before we had that sight of that report. That report has been due for a long time. Henry said we expected it sometime in the coming year, but we would have said that this time last year as well. It was due in the summer, then it was due in the autumn, and it's been hanging on. One of the reasons why Cash for Ash seems to have happened was this sense that this was Northern Ireland getting its mitts on free money from Great Britain, that the UK taxpayer would underwrite all of this, and therefore the desire from both sides was to maximise the take from the UK taxpayer. And that's one of the things that was a rude awakening when it was discovered that actually there was a bit of fine print on the Treasury clauses which said actually, no, you have to have cost controls because we're going to reclaim any overspend against the Northern Ireland budget. But also I thought one of the interesting things of the new agreement was the degree of sort of conditionality and supervision implied. And, you know, there've been lots of agreements in previous things, you know, Fresh Start, Stormont House, that actually haven't ever been implemented. And there's a big sense here that you're being watched to make sure you actually get on and do these things. There's conditionality attached to some of the money that will be coming forward to actually try and deal with some of these underlying issues.
Jonathan, how much of a player was Julian Smith in this? So, you know, Karen Bradley wasn't always greatly loved, I think, over there, it's fair to say. Julian Smith has really applied himself to this. He did quite a few knocks, didn't he, as chief whip during Theresa May's period. But he seems to have really got his teeth into this challenge of getting these two sides together.
Quite. And of course, as chief whip for several years, he was dealing with the DUP on a daily basis.
Indeed.
As the confidence and supply partner. So he got to know them extremely well. And that obviously made him well placed to help bring this agreement together. But I mean, Jill rightly identified a lot of weaknesses about the way Northern Ireland is run. The one thing she didn't mention is the fact that in the Northern Irish Assembly, there is no opposition. This is, I mean, you know, we all know because of the historical nature of sectarian politics in the province that is why we have the power-sharing executive, and that was written into the Good Friday Agreement and so on. But at the end of the day, I think there's only five members of the Assembly who are not members of a party which are part of the power-sharing executive. And you know, we'll talk later about the Labour leadership election and how there ought to be a Labour leader to hold the Conservative government to account. But who is there at Stormont actually keeping a watch and holding to account the power-sharing executive that has now been reformed because all the parties are in it together?
Do you think that's part of the problem, Henry? It's a long way from what we would think of as being sort of normal politics in any sense, isn't it?
Well, there was a debate within the Ulster Unionist Party, one of the big five, whether it would be better to be the official opposition and, you know, scrutinise this coalition or be inside the tent, you know, exercising some power. And they decided in the end to go in, and they end up getting the health portfolio, which could be a, you know, cliches abound, but a poison chalice for them, you know, because that's the big issue that people care about the most, as they do in Britain. And it is surprising that after 20-odd years of the Good Friday Agreement that politics has not evolved enough where at least one party can feel confident enough not to step out of the executive tent and become, you know, the official opposition.
I mean, in the last executive, actually, it was much more of a two-party executive with a bit of an opposition. But I think, you know, opposition was a bit nascent and people weren't really quite clear how to do opposition or scrutiny or those sorts of things that we more or less take for granted over here. But you know, this is a very weird form of government that Northern Ireland has. Yeah, we all know why, but the sort of history of basically saying you have to have a government between the parties of the two communities and they sort of, you know, live together and die together, which is what we saw when Martin McGuinness stood down, is a very strange form of government. You know, we found it quite difficult to cope with coalition for 5 years here. People didn't really like it, couldn't work out where decisions were being made, how to hold people accountable. But that was a voluntary coalition. The Northern Ireland one is a mandated coalition. It's a really quite strange form of government to make work.
Yeah, and who do you chuck out when things go wrong, I suppose. Jonathan, I wonder how much you think the DUP's handling of the Brexit issue played into what's now happened. They were very powerful, weren't they, in Theresa May, under Theresa May's administration. Boris Johnson tried to bring Arlene Foster on side and ultimately just dumped her, really.
Yes, but then the DUP, obviously, during the general election, took a different view about the withdrawal agreement than the Conservative Party.
Yeah.
And yet they still lost two seats at the general election and saw their vote share go down. So, you know, they clearly didn't have a great general election. And you know, and there may be a bigger question for them coming down the line when the Cash for Ash scandal report finally comes out. You know, will Arlene Foster be able to survive its findings as First Minister? If not, who then becomes First Minister? Is it someone from within the current Assembly? Does Geoffrey Donaldson, the now leader of the Westminster Group, go back over to Northern Ireland and find a seat? Because obviously, under the Assembly rules, you don't have by-elections. Someone can just stand down and is replaced by a nominee. Or Nigel Dodds, who lost his Belfast North seat at the general election, could he re-emerge as First Minister of Northern Ireland?
I mean, Sinn Féin won't get off lightly of this either. Their ministers were in charge of agriculture during this scheme as well. I understand they'll come in for some criticism as well. So it's not in their interest, I think, to pull the whole thing down. But you might see a changing of the guard at the top. But that would be, I think that would be enough to keep the power-sharing deal in situ. But as I say, they only really have 2 years because there's another election coming. So that's why I think it'll survive up until the next poll.
Interesting. And we should just talk also about the border issue, Jill. That this is, you know, going to be one of the huge challenges, perhaps the biggest challenge, isn't it, of implementing Boris Johnson's withdrawal agreement, is how to deal with this border and the Irish Sea.
The truth is that an awful lot of the detail is still to be worked out in a slightly mysterious body called the Joint Committee. Part of the new agreement is that Northern Ireland gets a say in the Joint Committee. Representatives from the executive will be invited along. The EU has made clear that representatives from the Republic of Ireland will also be there on the Joint Committee. And I think one of the really interesting changes that we're going to see over the coming year on Brexit is that actually having spent the first 3 years of Brexit, where Ireland was the huge big problem, the stumbling block getting in the way of the sort of withdrawal the UK wanted, Ireland now is really switching sides, because actually, you know, there will be unity of view, I think, between the Irish Republic and the Northern Irish representatives, that they want to make the Northern Ireland Protocol as invisible and as onerous as you can get away with in line with EU law. And the Irish will be the people in the sort of, you know, future Brexit negotiations who basically want to maintain trade with the UK on as similar terms as now. And they're going to be our biggest allies. And I think one of the really interesting things, you talked about Julian Smith, who I think did very well, you know, has, I think, played Northern Ireland much better than his predecessors, but had big advantages like the disappearance of the confidence and supply agreement. But one of the things that I thought was very interesting last week was that he seemed to be forming a really good partnership as well with Tony Oshter, Simon Coveney, who was also there, you know, playing up the Irish government's role in the new agreement. And they seem to be sharing the limelight in quite a sort of useful way in the sense of building that future partnership between the UK and Ireland, both on Northern Ireland, but I think also on the future relationship with the EU for the UK.
Do you think that's right, Jonathan? That's quite an optimistic look to the year ahead about you know, handling these, the practicalities of these border issues and the future relationship.
Yeah, I agree a lot with a lot of what Jill said there, particularly about the fact that the Republic of Ireland is going to want as invisible and frictionless a deal between the EU and the UK as possible, in terms of the fact that the Republic relies so much on trade with Great Britain, not so much Northern Ireland, actually Great Britain, it's kind of east-west trade. And all this goes back to the nub of what a lot of Brexiteers said at the beginning, was that, you know, you should have been talking about the trade deal in parallel with issues surrounding the Northern Irish border, because what happens at the Northern Irish border very much depends upon whether there are tariffs or not, or other barriers that may or may not be in place.
OK, we'll leave it there for now. After the break, we'll talk about the power of trust in the Brexit negotiations, why Huawei could be a particularly big thorn in Johnson's side, and what's next for the Labour leadership contenders. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. We're fast approaching the 31st of January, a date that many of us thought would never come, Brexit Day. I'm sure you never thought it would never come, Jonathan. but it did seem a little bit like that. And already Boris Johnson is being presented with questions about Britain's future place in the world. So we've had the Iran attack and how to respond to that. And this week we've had this issue of Huawei, haven't we? And, you know, does Britain use Huawei's technology? Donald Trump has a very, very clear view about this. Some of his officials came over and told journalists, you know, it's a terrible security risk. There are going to be a lot of questions, aren't there, Jill, where it's quite hard not to edge in one direction, either towards Europe and its view, or towards the US and its view. And Boris Johnson's going to have to tread that line quite carefully, isn't he?
Well, absolutely everything's going to be interpreted through that lens of, is Johnson closer to the EU on this? On Iran, to date, he's been closer to the EU, doing things with Germany and France, not necessarily the EU, but with the big European players, I think probably more accurately. Or is he appearing to perhaps compromise the UK's first best outcome to suck up a bit to Donald Trump and the US with an eye on a trade deal? I think one of the important things here is really to do a hard-headed analysis of actually what's going to be the benefit to the UK of a trade deal. They've already taken some of the big US asks off the table. If you say we're sensitive about access to the NHS, that's a big ask for US pharma who want higher drug prices. They've always hated the way we regulate drug prices in the UK. We're saying we don't want to sort of observe US agricultural standards. We're not going to get much from the US on services because there isn't a single market in services in the US itself. I mean, the federal government cannot deliver on a lot of the asks on services because so much is still at state level. So I think we really need a proper appraisal about, is there much there? Or as I think Liam Fox was saying yesterday, quite interestingly, back at the Institute for Government, should we actually be looking at some of the other tools to boost trade, which aren't negotiated government to government, are actually about just, you know, improving UK export performance and doing other things? I think that arguably is a more productive way of going, because Treasury's own analysis, the government's own analysis published under Theresa May, November 2018, basically said you can do a whole bunch of trade deals with other non-European countries, but they don't really amount to very much in terms of long-term GDP. And there are quite a lot of really difficult political issues you're going to have to navigate to land significant trade deals. And I think you need that before you actually say, where does that rank in our foreign policy preferences? How much are we prepared to sacrifice, if you like, to a president who really does have, are you against us or are you with us sort of mentality to get that trade deal? What's it really worth in terms of, you know, maybe sacrificing at the margin a bit of foreign policy sovereignty, which is, after all, one of the things that Brexit's supposed to give us back?
Jonathan, how do we toe this line as we launch off into the future?
Well, surprise, surprise, we're going to be an independent sovereign nation and we can make our own decisions. And, you know, you rightly say that, you know, on Iran, yes, the UK has been looking more towards alliances with Europe. But on other issues, you're perhaps looking towards a more American point of view. And frankly, each decision can be made on a case-by-case basis. You don't need to sign up in its entirety to any one particular point of view from any other part of the country. I mean, on Huawei, I think there was a very strong intervention in the Commons at the beginning of the week from Bob Seeley, who was on the Foreign Affairs Committee in the last Parliament and who I think is seeking to become Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman to challenge the incumbent Tom Tugendhat, who was saying, you know, as far as he was concerned, Huawei was an agent of the Chinese state, and he was deeply suspicious of the idea that we should give them access to setting up the 5G network. And I think I'm right in saying that the two cabinet ministers on the Committee of Nine who are yet to sign off on this decision are the Home Secretary and the Defence Secretary, who are the ones that probably have the biggest vested interests in this whole issue.
Do you think this might be one way we could lean towards Donald Trump and get a few brownie points potentially?
I don't think it's about brownie points. I think it's about making the right decision for the country. And, you know, I think Ryan's saying that both Australia and New Zealand have already agreed not to go down the Huawei route with their 5G network. So, you know, this would not be a case of the UK, if it does take that decision, standing alone.
We tend to focus on trade, don't we, when we think about the future relationship. We're going to hear more, do you think, about security and, you know, those international issues as the EU talks get properly underway? Or do we have to stick to a sort of very bare-bones trade deal because we haven't got much time?
Well, I think both sides do want to actually continue security cooperation. One of the things that was really oddly missing, I thought, from the Conservative manifesto was it actually said nothing at all about the prospects for security cooperation with the EU. So we don't really know what the Johnson government agenda is on security cooperation. We know that people like the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, in previous incarnations certainly had reservations about the European arrest warrant, was not a big fan of that. But there are, you know, they will be having quite heavy lobbying from the police about access to databases, things like that. You know. So I think it is going to be quite a big strand that's got to be concluded in parallel, because otherwise, if you don't have that, then you fall back on clunkier international conventions that predated the sort of development of the internal security cooperation agenda. I think on defence external security cooperation, that's clearly a bit different, actually. The EU wasn't sort of really, yeah, the EU may go in a different direction without the UK there, because really the UK had been a brake on some of the ambitions for more integrated European defence policy. But on internal security, there'll be a lot of lobbying about maintaining access to databases in particular, and about police cooperation, you know, having something to substitute for the European arrest warrant. But the interesting thing is, the EU itself will find it difficult to agree much for the UK beyond its normal offers to third countries. I think the case of a sort of extradition agreement, you know, with Norway took years and years to land, and Norway's a member of the European Economic Area, member of Schengen. So there's some quite big barriers to that, but it will probably get much less attention than trade because everybody thinks this is just about trade, but we'll have to see how it surfaces because people are interested. And I think your story you mentioned at the start about, you know, the trust of UK handling of data or UK's way it's managed things is going to be a slightly recurrent theme. One of the first things that the UK will be seeking is a data adequacy decision for data transfers with the EU. And the EU is already sort of rumbling, well, we apply a different standard to third countries to the one that we apply to EU members. We're not sure that we think the way the UK treats data meets our standards for third country safeguards. So expect those sorts of rows to be going on as well. But at the moment, both sides are sort of stacking up cards to be used in the negotiations.
Meanwhile, yeah, that issue of trust is going to recur, isn't it, as this goes on. Let's turn briefly to the Labour leadership contest. We're down to five candidates. Poor old Clive Lewis has dropped off the bottom of the list, had lots of radical ideas about political reform and so on, but doesn't seem to be seen as a winner by his colleagues in Parliament. Jonathan, do you think it's a bit ironic that the leading candidate in this race, Keir Starmer, was a very strong advocate of Remain, which obviously some in Labour would say was exactly what lost them this general election?
Yes, I do. And I think that the Labour Party, in a sense, are rushing into this contest. I mean, I look back to the Tory leadership in 2005, when the Conservatives suffered a third defeat in a row under Michael Howard. And Michael Howard, I thought Jeremy Corbyn, when he announced that he wouldn't be fighting the next election, effectively wanted there to be a longer period of, you know, investigation into what went wrong and to what might be done better. And that's what Michael Howard did in 2005. He ensured that there was a very long period before the leadership contest happened at the end of 2005. Whereas we're seeing the Labour Party rush into this contest, and it's very personality driven rather than policy driven, because I haven't detected a huge amount of differences between the candidates in terms of where they differed with the manifesto on which they all stood just a few weeks ago. And on Brexit, you've got every single candidate for the leadership and deputy leadership having last week voted against the withdrawal agreement, which to the public is seen as still not accepting that Brexit is happening and trying to stop the Brexit deal from being done. Now, the Labour Party lost dozens of seats at the general election in December in Leave voting areas, particularly in the Midlands and the North and North Wales. And I wonder what message it's sending out to voters in those seats by simply continuing to oppose everything the government's doing on Brexit. I note that, you know, even Lisa Nandy voted against the deal, having voted for it back in October at second reading in its first attempt under Boris Johnson, although she did vote against the timetable motion. You know, you've got to wonder, do they get it? Do they understand that there are literally millions of Leave voting traditional Labour supporters who didn't back the party at the general election, who are still going to be scratching their heads as to where the party's going on this issue?
Jill, are you absolutely gripped by this leadership race?
Not particularly, because I think I'm not really in a mood to be gripped for 3 months by this, particularly when for quite a long time to come, the government clearly has a very secure position, and you know, it looks like a bit of sort of people actually who aren't necessarily going to play a sort of very major role very soon, sorting things out. But I think there are two things that strike me as interesting, you know, as a very external observer. The first is the fact that we all thought it was a great idea to give memberships the sort of final say in electing leaders. So I think there's this really interesting issue of how do you run, first of all, to get the membership to support you? But then, you know, if your membership and your voters are in different places, how, having run to get the membership, do you then actually appeal to the people you need to be able to actually, you know, not just become leader of a party and stick in opposition forever and a day, but actually to become prime minister? The thing that strikes me as particularly odd in a sense about Labour, it goes to some things that Jonathan says, is that they simultaneously elect the leader and the deputy leader, but they don't run as tickets, because you could say, actually, if you look at the US president, the president then selects a running mate on the basis that they're weak in the Midwest, or they're weak among this sort of, you know, grouping, they won't appeal to Labour, so they do this, or they need the evangelicals, so they'll select a running mate who complements. But because we have these elections in parallel, you don't get a sort of, you know, Keir Starmer plus somebody who's not like Keir Starmer, sort of Uber Leaver or whatever, as a running mate, which you thought might appeal. There are quite a lot of good candidates for leader who won't become leader, arguably, because, you know, only one's going to become leader, who might actually be really good candidates for deputy leader to complement that. And they don't allow themselves that possibility. So it seems to me a really sort of weird and possibly dysfunctional process in terms of actually getting a leadership team that delivers what the party needs. Because you would say, you know, if you go for this sort of person as leader, actually, how do you make then the case that the party as a whole can appeal to a broad church? They seem to be sort of doing, by doing this parallel track approach, they risk having two sort of mini-me's at the top and having quite a narrow base of appeal.
And there's another question that I wonder whether the Labour Party ought to be asking itself, which I haven't really heard much of thus far, is it electing the person it wants to be the next Prime Minister, Or is it electing the person it wants to ensure the Labour Party doesn't die and just to keep it alive and to make some progress towards a future election victory? Because from the sheer sense of numbers, the fact the Labour Party just had the worst defeat since 1935, most commentators are thinking it would be very, very difficult in a single heave, in a single election, to become a majority government at the election that will come in 4.5 years' time. And, you know, one does wonder which question is the party seeking to answer. And there's an argument that different candidates would be placed differently depending on whether you are trying to choose a prime minister or someone to revive the party and just give it a sense of oomph and to help it on its way to recovery.
And you're also trying to look for the person who's most likely to be able to attack or wrong foot Boris Johnson too, aren't you? Who do you think the Conservatives will be more concerned about?
I mean, a lot of people have said this. I think the person who would be most challenging to Boris Johnson is probably Jess Phillips. Now, Jess is a maverick politician. She's only ever been a backbencher. She hasn't been in Parliament that long. She's arguably not the most consistent of politicians. Indeed, you know, just in the last fortnight, her view about whether we should join or rejoin the European Union seemed to change within 24 hours. And she is, I think, would happily allow me to call her gobby. You know, I think she's probably rather proud of that.
Yeah.
and I think against Boris Johnson in the House of Commons, she would present a huge challenge. However, looking at the Labour Party membership that we would are led to believe is you know, very much in the kind of Corbynista direction, one imagines would not be very well disposed to her because she was so anti-Corbyn. And you know, a lot of this contest will be seen through the prism of how people felt about the previous regime.
I think it's one of the interesting things about how much will Parliament matter for the next 5 years. I mean, the government, you know, is taking its time to set up select committees. You know, Prime Minister, you know, made an appearance at Prime Minister's Questions, but it's now down to half an hour under the new speaker. It's going to be sort of, you know, not quite the sort of same sort of occasion, arguably, with all those supporters on the back benches. And we're not going to have knife-edge vote after knife-edge vote as we've got used to over the next 3 years. And it's very notable that, you know, if you look at the Conservative leader who gave Tony Blair the hardest time, it was probably William Hague, who, you know, everybody said, you know, was really good at Prime Minister's Questions, things like that. But actually, yeah, was anyone really paying attention? So I think it's sort of quite interesting as to think, where is the battleground going to be? Is it going to be in Parliament, where I think, you know, Jess Phillips clearly has merits on taking on sort of, you know, the Prime Minister probably personally. If you wanted someone who's doing a forensic destruction of the minutiae of whatever the Prime Minister's doing, if he gives Parliament any sight of his Brexit deal that he ultimately does, then Keir Starmer's probably the person who you would say, as a lawyer, is better at the forensic destruction, whatever. But actually, will any of us be watching? It'd be very interesting to see where the BBC Parliament viewing figures go.
Yeah.
And of course,
yeah.
if the Labour Party is trying to regain ground in the Midlands and the north of England, where it obviously lost a huge amount of seats at the general election, is having another North London MP, metropolitan, liberal, really going to be the person to appeal to those kinds of seats? And I'm not sure that Keir Starmer is.
Well, 2020 certainly hasn't started quietly. My thanks to all our guests, Rory Carroll, Henry McDonald, Jill Rutter and Jonathan Isaby. If you want even more Brexit talk, look for the latest Brexit Means episode, where my colleague John Henley and the panel look at what changes 31st of January will bring. And if you want to hear yours truly talking about the Labour leadership campaign some more, make sure to listen in to tomorrow's Today in Focus, when I'll be talking through the latest with Anoushka. But that's all from us this week. The producer was Danielle Stevens. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.